Most of the work that I will be talking about today has been done in collaboration with my long-term collaborator, Aline Panatescu. And also, most of the things that I know about the field, Kamal Ebersh, I have learned from Aline, at least things which are right, I have learned from him. All the things that are wrong that I know, that's not his responsibility. So long-duration gamma ray burst, we know certainly in a number of cases, maybe all of the cases, are produced as a result of in the collapsar, according to the collapsar model, which is to say explosion of a massive star. And even back in 99, Chevalier and Lee pointed out that if indeed these long-duration bursts are produced as a result of collapse of massive star, we should be able to see their signature in the afterglow, where the shock would be going out in a wind-like medium, density is stratified as 1 over r squared, versus a uniform density medium. So one should be able to tell the difference between whether it is a massive star which is collapsing or something else by looking at the afterglow. And they provided a detailed model for the afterglow, afterglow physics in a wind-like stratified medium. And indeed, there are a number of cases where we can tell that we are seeing the explosion taking place in a medium which is stratified like a wind, so again, 1 over r squared. And this is one of certainly better cases, maybe one of the best cases, of gamma ray burst 0210-04. This comes from a paper by Lee and Chevalier, where what you are seeing here is at early time, there was a shallow fall off of the light curve in the R band, optical R band, and then a steepening, and very consistent with what you expect for a wind-like medium. So that's certainly very good and very encouraging. And here in the list, in the table here, what I would like to show you is a number of cases of gamma ray burst for which we have got afterglow in the optical and X-ray and the radio. And a number of groups of people have tried to model these multi-wavelength afterglow radiation over a period of time that we see typically in these cases, maybe about a day to maybe tens of days, in some cases even a month or a year in this case, very long-lived radio afterglow. So a lot of assumptions go into these calculations of multi-wavelength modeling of data and trying to figure out things like, you know, the property of the gamma ray burst, the property of the medium in the vicinity of gamma ray burst, and so on and so on. So there could be a lot of uncertainty there. What I would like to do is not talk about the modeling itself. That has been discussed by many people. It's more interesting to discuss, for instance, this column here shows whether these bursts seem to be going off in a wind-like medium, yes, meaning yes, the data, afterglow data is consistent. No, meaning no, it's not consistent with going off in a wind, and so on. So that's one issue. Even if there are a few cases of these long-duration bursts where you can establish for sure that these things are not going off in a wind-like medium, you have a puzzle, an interesting one. Many possible solutions are there, but nevertheless, very interesting thing that we need to understand and make sure that we are confident that these bursts are indeed going off in a medium which is uniform versus wind. So we got to establish that with certain amount of certainty. And so that's what I wish to address, one issue. The other thing I would wish to address is, if you look at the density here, the densities are not typically, well, they are typically order of maybe a few particles per cc, varying from very low density in this case, very exceptional case, to the highest you see is something like 27 particle per cc. When you might expect that if there are massive stars, they are embedded in a giant molecular cloud with much higher density. We don't see that. And so, we would like to know if, for instance, the modeling work of afterglow is being carried out in a way which is incorrect, our models are not right. And so it's a consequence of the modeling that is giving you this artificially low density or not. So these are the questions that I would like to address critically and in a broad sense, as opposed to looking at just more modeling of afterglow. And then this last column, if you wish, it just shows you whether there was a supernova-like signature seen or not. It shouldn't really be taken very seriously in the sense that most of these NOAs really are affected by lots of different things, selection effects, spotty observations, lots of different things, bright afterglow where a faint supernova would have been hidden. I have listed these things here, but I don't want you to take this particular thing too seriously. The next two slides is really meant for roughly half of you, or maybe more than half of you, in the supernova community, so just so that we are talking about the same things and just to point out certain basic things about the gamma ray afterglow. So let's take the density of the external medium to be stratified, falling off as r to certain power minus s. S is a number which is 0 for a uniform medium and 2 for a wind-like medium. And then using the energy conservation of the shock wave, if it's adiabatic, if there is little loss of energy, and energy is conserved, then this is the swept-up mass times gamma square, is a conserved quantity, and that sets the scale for deacceleration. That's the distance at which roughly half of the energy of the gamma ray burst explosion is now shared with the surrounding medium, and that length scale is about a tenth of a parsec. And so the afterglows, when we are missing afterglows, we are making a measurement of the property of the medium from about a tenth of a parsec to about a parsec. So that's the distance scale that is being explored by the afterglow observation. And this particular region is affected by the progenitor wind only in the last 100 years of its lifetime. That's really all that has been explored, and for which we have no empirical understanding from Ulfray star or any stars. So we have very little idea from direct observations what's going on. Then we can convert, for instance, the time, relate the time with the radius r, and using that we can recast this conservation equation as a quantity here which depends on the radius and the time, as being this combination being constant, and from there we can read off that the radius increases of this fireball, of this shock going into the interstellar medium, that radius increases with time as time to the power a quarter for uniform medium and time to the power half for a wind-like medium. So again, the point of this is the following, that if you are exploring a region, for instance, between, say, for instance, in time from 1 day to 10 days, you are exploring a region which has increased in size depending on uniform density medium and the wind medium. In the case of the wind medium, it has only increased in size by a factor of 3. A small change in radius is all you are exploring. If you do observations, 1 day to 10 days, and even smaller in the case of a uniform density medium. And since the flux scales as square root of density, and the reason for why this scaling is square root of density is because the magnetic field strength, if the magnetic field is generated behind the shock, as probably you have heard from Medvedev, then the magnetic field scales as a square root of density because of equipartition arguments. And in that case, the flux, for instance, so then you compare. You are trying to see if you can see the signature of a wind versus uniform density medium. So you have to ask yourself, how much of a difference in flux do you expect in these two cases? And the answer is that if the difference in the flux is a square root of density, then the difference in the flux is going to be a square root of t minus half is what you are going to get in the terms of the difference in the flux. Let me just be a little bit more precise about it. So for instance, if you started with the same flux at a certain time, initial time, let's just call it t0, and then you went tenfold in time, then the flux is going to drop off a little faster for a wind-like medium than for a uniform density medium, and so the flux at a later time, 10 times t0, would be smaller for a wind-like medium by a factor of 3 compared to if the medium were to be uniform. So you are basically asking whether you can tell the difference in the factor of 3 in flux between uniform density and wind-like medium. And the answer is that, you know, if we knew everything else, that, then you could. But unfortunately, there are lots of uncertainty. You don't know. There are many parameters that you have no idea how to calculate these things from ab initio first principle. So you make an assumption about the fraction of energy going in electrons, fraction going in magnetic field, P being constant. All of these things we don't really know. And so there is uncertainty in these quantities. And there could also be, there could be some time dependence. So you fold in, or you, or if there were to be any time dependence, then this factor of 3 is easily masked in the unknown property of these dimensionless quantities. So it would be very difficult. So for instance, you might have a wind, and you might infer that you have a uniform density medium by simply, for instance, increasing epsilon b a little bit over a period of time. And the dependence is almost linear. That is to say, the flux has almost linear dependence on these quantities, epsilon e and epsilon b. So just a slight increase, for instance, in epsilon e and epsilon b, and a slight adjustment in p could fool you in thinking that you have a uniform density medium when actually you have got a wind-like medium. So one has to keep these things in mind. Now, clearly, the hope was that in the Swift era, we would have a much better situation in the sense that we would be making an observation with a much larger lever arm in time. So instead of just making observation, for instance, going from, say, 1 day to 10 day, we would have observations going from 100 seconds to few days, maybe 10 days. And so we would have an increase in the time coverage by a factor of 1,000. And therefore, see, the difference between a uniform density medium and a wind-like medium in the terms of the flux would now be a factor of 100 at, that is to say, you start with the same flux initially, then you, the difference grows with time as the square root of time, and so the difference will become a factor of 100, and that would be very difficult to hide in all these microphysics uncertain parameters, and you would be able to tell whether you have got wind or you have got uniform density medium. But unfortunately, as most of you now know, that's not the way things turned out. And the reason, I'm just showing this particular plot that is taken from a nice architectural paper. You may have seen, I don't know if you have seen already in this, but all I wish to point out here is that there are lots of interesting physics going on which makes life difficult for what I have just said. So you see, for instance, there is a rapid phase of decline in the X-ray, and then some flares and flattening and all that, which we know is not coming from anything to do with the property of the surrounding medium. It's other things are going on. So which means that you are limited now in observations that you can make use of from something on the order of an hour to a few days. So you have not increased the time coverage by a factor of 1,000 that you thought that you might in the Swift era. May have increased, in fact, only by a factor of a few in the terms of the ability to do these afterglow modeling. In fact, if anything, and I'm going to say this, if anything, I think things have become a little worse as far as afterglow modeling is concerned. I know I may take a little bit of heat for that, but that's where things stand, in the sense that we don't really see many follow-up observations in the optical, for instance, spanning 10 days or so, and we're missing all these jet breaks and so on. And one of the things, one of the good ways that we can tell the difference between uniform density medium and wind is by looking at the jet break. If you see a jet break, and the jet break is sharp break, here what you're looking at is the temporal decay index alpha, which is plotted as a function of time, somewhat in an arbitrary scale here, although it's shown here in seconds, but you can slide it at by some constant number. So if you see, for instance, the sharp increase in alpha, the light curve is steepening very rapidly, and by a substantial amount, say, for instance, steepening by a factor of t, 1 over t, then you know that this jet is not propagating in a wind, which would give you a much smoother increase in alpha with time. This is, again, I understand it has already been covered by Jonathan in his talk that he gave yesterday. So I do not want to dwell, but simply to point out that if you could see, or the cases where you see very sharp increase in the light curve steepening, there almost certainly you are dealing with, you can have good confidence that you are dealing with a medium which is uniform and not wind-like stratified. So for instance, in the table that you saw, 990510 was one of the bursts for which it said, the column said, no wind. And we are very confident, we can be very confident, no wind, because you see such a sharp increase, sharp steepening of the light curve in the optical. 990123 also fell in that category, in this category. Other way that you can tell the difference between wind and a uniform density medium is by looking at sub-millimeter observations. This is a figure that is adopted from our work a couple of years ago. The different panels simply are showing you the flux as a function of time here, the time in days, at different frequencies, X-ray, optical, sub-millimeter, radio band. And all I wish to point out and draw your attention to is that the biggest difference in S2, and this is S2 medium, S2, whenever I say S2, it's wind-like medium, and uniform density medium, that difference is most pronounced in sub-millimeter, at sub-millimeter frequencies, and at early time less than a day. But unfortunate thing is that, you know, both, one has to do a rapid follow-up in the sub-millimeter, and also the fluxes are quite low. So it's not so easy. Even in the radio band, where the fluxes are something, you know, in good cases are order of a millijansky, in sub-millimeter they are smaller, whereas you're limited to about a millijansky in sub-millimeter, I understand. Let me summarize this particular part of the talk. So we are seeing evidence for wind in a few cases, but in many, we do not see evidence for wind. In fact, we can be quite confident that the medium is not stratified as a wind in the vicinity, which means 10th of a parsec to a parsec for many of the bars. So these cases, certainly, we are very confident that the medium is not wind-like. Also, we can make a more general statement that the wind-like medium is not likely to be a common feature of gamma-ray bursts. And that has to do with the lack of bright optical reverse shock emission that it will produce if you have got a wind-like medium. And this figure shows this thing, this particular point. What you're looking at in these different color-coded points here is the triangles here are reverse shock emission in the optical band when the medium is S2 versus when the medium is S0, uniform density medium. And you can see this is plotted as some crazy parameter space thing, so please forget about the x-axis. This is just simply... So this is showing the difference between the two. And you can see the difference in the flux between the two is more than an order of magnitude, maybe more like two order of magnitude. So you expect to see a much brighter reverse shock emission from S2 medium. And here is the situation. This is all swift bursts for which there is data. And you can see, for instance, there are detection at early time. This is 100 seconds for a number of cases. But they are not nearly as bright as certainly we saw for 990123 and also 02-1211. And they're typically actually quite faint, 15th, 16th, 17th magnitude. And also, the other part of the diagram is just the upper limits, which are also, in many cases, very stringent upper limits, 16th, 17th, 18th magnitude at 100 seconds. So this is telling you this whole business of reverse shock emission is clearly not as common and not clearly as bright as you would have that as people had thought. So of course, one possibility is that you have no wind, for instance, as Roger pointed out in his talk. You have a shocked wind, for instance, that may homogenize the medium. That's the possibility indeed. It certainly requires a high pressure medium, as again Roger pointed out. I'm not going to talk any more about it. I will simply point out that there is another possibility that if you have gamma ray bursts which are produced by stars which are rapidly rotating, maybe the wind structure of these stars is very different. Maybe there is very little wind coming out along the polar axis where the relativistic jet is coming out. Now, I have here in the parentheses said Goldreich conjecture. That's too strong a word. All that Goldreich did was that when I gave this talk, I gave a talk at Princeton, he said that, well, you know, what about this particular possibility? So I think it's other things may be going on. I want to consider the case, for instance, of the low density. We are finding typically low density when you expected to see high densities. Now, is that an artifact of afterglow modeling? I think the answer is no in the following sense, that the density cannot be very high. And the reason the density cannot be very high is that if the density were to be much higher than we are finding, then the radio will have a problem. The radio frequencies, 8 gigahertz frequency, for instance, that Frail, Kulkarni, and collaborators use, it would be self-absorbed. And we would see very often in these cases a rapidly rising radio light curve, such as, for instance, was seen for this particular supernova and many others, as you saw in the talks earlier this morning. We don't see that. So we know that the density can be, in a generic sense, the density can be very high, of order 1,000 particles per cc. Not allowed. Just not allowed. And also, early optical emission also provide very interesting constraint on the density. And these are not coming from detailed afterglow modeling and suffering from, you know, unknown epsilon E's and all that numbers. No, these are very general arguments. So you know that the density isn't very high. And we also know that the same game that is played for short-duration bursts seems to work fine. Short-duration bursts, Aline's work, Alicia Soderbergh's work, and others, they find low density, and nobody questions that, because that's what you expected. And so the technique seems to work okay for short-duration bursts. Why shouldn't it work for long-duration bursts? Not a very good argument, but argument nevertheless that should be kept in mind. Now, particularly troubling is the case of 990123, very low density. And you ask yourself, are we fooling ourselves? Is the modeling really correct? Can the density really be this low? And here, there is a very interesting argument, completely independent of afterglow modeling, and that's the following. The argument is due to Beloborodov, and it points out the following. This is a burst where you saw prompt optical emission, very bright prompt optical emission, during the gamma ray burst. So electrons which are producing the optical will also be cooling as a result of inverse Compton scattering the prompt gamma rays very rapidly. And therefore, you wouldn't see these electrons would cool on a very short time scale, and you wouldn't see optical emission lasting for about 800 seconds that you saw associated with this burst, unless the density were to be smaller than 10 to the power minus 2 particle per cc. So as I say, this has nothing to do with afterglow modeling, completely different argument, and there are actually a number of other arguments of this kind which you can use, and you have. So you can't get out of this low density issue. It's there. It seems to be there. Different lines are telling you it's there. But then X-ray absorption line, the X-ray absorption tells you a different story. And a number of people have looked at X-ray absorption for gamma ray burst host, and they find numbers which are varies over orders of magnitude, but something on the order of 10 to the 22 particle per square centimeter is the column density. And then not a whole lot of optical extinction associated with this. So you say, okay, all right, the dust grains are destroyed by gamma ray bursts, but that only can happen within a couple of parsec. So you can take, for instance, this column density in a couple of parsec, say 10 parsec, and convert and get a mean density within a couple of parsec. And that number is order of 1,000 particles per cc, clearly at odds with afterglow modeling. Right? So something is going on. I don't know what it is, but that is something that there's something going on. And there are a number of ways out of it, but I simply want to point out that there is an issue here that we need to understand. Now, it could be, and maybe, it could be, for instance, that all of these arguments, for instance, that I gave you for 99.0123 in particular and more broadly speaking, they are all wrong. Maybe there is something really intrinsically incorrect with these arguments. And maybe what's wrong is that our assumption is wrong. Maybe the emission that you are seeing in 99.0123, which is the best example we have for river shock emission, and also very good example is 0.2.12.11, maybe those emissions are not coming from river shock. They have nothing to do with river shock, and all the arguments that I gave you, they go out of the window, no longer valid, and so that's the kind of drastic thing you might need. The other problem with 99.0123 is that it also requires this very general argument tell you that the Lorentz factor of the jet is greater than 1,000, greater than 1,000. Low density, very low density, greater than 1,000. So a number of things start to be somewhat uncomfortable, maybe more than a little bit uncomfortable. And then you wonder whether your interpretation of river shock giving rise to this prompt optical is really robust and correct. And I would say that needs to be called into question. And maybe what may be going on, that the rapidly falling early afterglow that we thought are coming from river shock really are not coming from river shock. In fact, now, post-Swift era, that wouldn't really surprise you maybe a whole lot. Even though Aline, when I mentioned this to Aline, in fact, this is an idea, I must say, I had thought about it, Aline thought about it independently, and I mentioned to Aline this morning that I may mention this thing in my talk. He said that's fine. Have you got your bulletproof vest with you or not? I mean, the community has taken this idea that this is probably part of the conventional wisdom. But the point here is the following, that in the Swift era, about 50% of the gamma ray bursts detected by Swift are detected or show a behavior of rapidly falling X-ray flux at early times. Between about 100 seconds to 300, 400 seconds, we see rapidly falling X-ray. And we know it's not coming from river shock. Probably not. There is one little possibility there, which I don't want to go into, but most likely not. It seems to be associated with the prompt gamma ray emission. So maybe the same mechanism may also give rise to the rapidly falling optical light curve that we see. And also, Frail, Kulkarni, and other people seem to find, for instance, flares in the radio band at a day. So we need to understand that. But I think, again, Swift era, we have a number of now observations showing the light curve flattening in the X-ray, which something is causing that. It may be late injection of energy. Variety of different possibilities, again, have been proposed. This is not the time and place to go into that. But we need to. We are faced with a number of issues here, which seem puzzling, even in isolation, but taken together, they seem to offer very contradictory evidence as to what may be going on. And so we need to keep an open mind and look at things more critically. So let me just summarize what we have, where things stand in my view. So we have a very mixed picture of wind. We know probably is there in few cases of long duration gamma ray burst, but definitely we have got at least few, maybe larger number of cases where we have really not only no evidence for wind, but we are pretty confident that we have got a uniform density or medium in the vicinity of gamma ray burst. The densities are not very high, and in one case very low. And so maybe something else is going on, as I say, with the river shock. So I would stop there.
Thank you very much. And I hope you have indeed your bulletproof vest on. There will be lots of questions. Peter.
Is related to the X-rays fall off, then you would predict that the optical would occur at a certain time scale behind the X-ray, right? Because you need, you know, the model would give you a quantitative prediction of what is the time delay at which you would get the steep fall off. So it would be an easy way to verify these conjecture.
Peter, you're right. The only thing that we don't know to make this thing more quantitative is the shape of the spectrum, the prompt gamma ray spectrum, below, for instance, a few keV. So we have a big uncertainty as to what may be going on between a few eV and a few keV in the terms of the prompt, the source which is giving rise to the prompt gamma ray emission. And that it does introduce quite a lot of uncertainty, but modulo that, what you say is certainly very correct.
So another quick question was that in your calculations of the reverse shock of your 2006 paper, did you consider, so you considered wind and constant external medium, but did you consider things like that the reverse shock might be relativistic in some cases, or that the ejecta might be more highly magnetized than the forward shock?
Yes, Peter, they were considered. By the way, I should point out one other thing. Credit also should go, the work was done also by Nakar and Piran, in similar spirit, in some sense, of the reverse shock emission. We have put in a lot more physics in the reverse shock, but similar conclusion is also arrived at by Nakar and Piran in a work which was done more than a year ago, year and a half ago. So,
I saw many hands in this area, but this person is the closest to
this. In the X-ray observations from SWIFT, we find these high column densities in something like half the cases. And the other half, they look like they're consistent with galactic column densities. So it looks to us like you can explain that just in terms of the relationship between the burst and some nearby molecular cloud. Sometimes you're on the near side, sometimes you're on the far side. Now, from our own galaxy, we know that we have associations of massive stars born near molecular clouds, but then right in the immediate vicinity, the density can be quite low, especially if there's been a pre-existing supernova explosion or something. So I guess the question is, you still have to explain the optical extinction, but you don't. That's not necessarily telling you anything about the immediate environment right around the burst in this sort of 0.1 to 1 parsec range, is it?
Well, the question is the following then. Do you take, for instance, the amount of dust associated with a certain column density to be the same as galactic value, much less than the galactic value, some different property of the grain, for instance? Those are all possibilities. And you can certainly play with those parameters. And certainly, for instance, if you were to choose and say that the amount of dust is smaller for a given column density compared to the galactic value by a factor of few tens, that may remove this problem between the, you know, optical extinction and the X-ray, for instance. I think this is something that is the work that I quoted by Strata and collaborator. Could it be within a few parsec? That depends very much. If really dust is destroyed, then it's not likely to be destroyed at a distance of hundreds of parsec. So.
Pawan, are we selecting against high densities in the sense of, obviously, X-ray and gamma rays penetrate quite easily and are not unaffected by density, effectively, but optical and radio are strongly suppressed above, say, 100.
Very good question and a very good point. I mean, we know X-ray is not affected, as you have already said, right? So we are seeing X-ray. Now, unfortunately, X-ray itself doesn't really tell you anything about the density. If the X-ray afterglow, most likely it is above the cooling frequency, and then it has very insensitive to the density. So based on that, we can say, so yeah, there is a possibility. There's a possibility, but see, what is the point here? The point here is the following. Even if, as I say, even if you have got one case, here more than one cases, where the density is low, you need to understand what's going on, right? So I was not trying to say that there is no case, for instance, with high density. There may be cases with high density, but I'm simply saying that there are cases with low density, with very low density, actually a few, at least one, and a good number of cases, they are not a small number of cases, maybe, you know, 30%, maybe 40%, we can maybe have some disagreement as to what that percentage is, but some fraction of the cases with low density, right? So there is a population of gamma ray bursts going off, so it appears, in the low density medium, right? So it is not saying that there may be a population of gamma ray bursts going off in a high density medium. That's great. We would, should be, a, meaning could there, indeed could be a selection effect against them, and they may be well there. But the fact is that we have got this other population, so it seems, in the low density medium.
No. I do not fully understand your point that circumstellar density of a few particles per centimeter cubed is low, because if a massive star loses, say, 10 solar masses and it spreads out over a bubble, say, 10 parsec wide, then that's what you end up with. 1,000 particles per centimeter cubed would be far more difficult to explain.
All right. Well, look, we are, as I say, we are exploring a region of a space which is about 10th of a parsec to about a parsec, right? So, and the density is declining with distance, right? So indeed, if you do the average density calculation, the way that you are doing in probably in your head, you're dominated by what's happening, the density at the largest scale, I mean, at larger distances. But it's not the 10 parsec that is being explored. It's a smaller distance. Say at one parsec, the density would be larger by a factor of 100 compared to this mean density that you...
Only in a free-streaming wind region. If it is indeed
that's
a shocked wind,
yeah,
then it works
right.
Perfect.
Yeah, that's right. It's a possible, very plausible solution. Of course, it does require high pressure, which may be... Yeah.
Two last questions.
In how many cases you can say confidently that you can rule out the constant density?
Okay. I will repeat the question. If I understand the question is, how many cases are there where you can rule out constant density? Did I hear your question right?
Yeah. Because you
yeah,
you,
no.
It might be consistent with both.
That's right. No. Very, that's good. The cases in the table that I showed, there are. I don't know about 0210-04. Roger, could you say whether that is ruled out? It's not ruled out, right? I would say, Udi, I would say the following. Based on what I know and what we have done, I would say that there is not a strong case that I see where I say that constant density is ruled out to, say, 3 sigma. Aline, you are here. Two cases? But the difference is 3 sigma?
Can you put your conclusions up again?
Sure.
I was just referring to the second point that you had out there.
Yeah.
And yeah. I don't know if there's really a conflict between the, you know, the absorption column densities and the low densities are pretty far in, right? 0.1 to 1 parsecs, like you said. Most of the absorption, like if you look at some of the recent things where they say the absorption could be occurring at tens to hundreds of parsecs where you may have the dense shell from the subtop medium, so I don't know if there's any problem with that at all, is it?
Well, the problem, the way I see it, is that, okay, say for instance you have a dense shell at tens or hundreds of parsec, so you are getting a certain absorption in the X-ray, right? But not corresponding extinction in the optical. If you were to assume that this dense shell has the same, for instance, ratio of dust to gas, let's talk about it a little bit more.
Because of time, I think we should go